Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Good evening and welcome to the History of Germany podcast. I'm Travis Dow. And the last couple episodes, we took a break from the chronological mini-series and we covered the Dänewerk, the Slavs within, at least modern-day Germany, the Wends and Sorbs, and even the classic 13-course meal. Those are all medieval topics that take place in the general time frame of the episodes that follow the chronological order, and the last mini-series was on the Saxon dynasty, the Ottos, and the Leudolfingers, as that dynasty is called. And today we start discussing the dynasty that took over after Henry II, the last Saxon king and emperor, for a while. And again, this is set up for a few upcoming topics to give you a context in when the following events happen. So, i.e., we are now officially in the 11th century and in the Salian dynasty of the Holy Roman Empire. That's where we are chronologically, and some of the upcoming topics I'm setting up with these couple episodes are mostly around the church, like the investiture controversy, also the Great Schism will both come up in this episode and next, and I'll devote an entire separate episode to that soon, probably the next episode, with the host of the History of Papacy podcast, Stephen Guerra. And I want to do an episode on the evolution of castles in time and take a look at how the average person lived, like your average household, which I did with the Celts, I did that with the Germans and Romans, etc. Because honestly, I think that stuff is more interesting than going king to king. And we'll even take a look at Yiddish, which developed in this time period. And that's sort of as preparation as we are making our way to the Crusades. And to give you a broader scope of what Germany was like in the Middle Ages, where it all fits into context of the wider world. But first, today, we're continuing with the High Middle Ages in the Holy Roman Empire. And when the Otto, Leudolfinger, or Saxon dynasty, that's all the same thing, when they died out, we see the beginnings of the Salian dynasty, its founding, etc., and we're going to have to get caught up to where we left off with the Saxons. From 1024, when the last Saxon king, Henry II, dies, we start a new dynasty that lasts about a century, up until 1125. This episode specifically will cover the first two kings of that dynasty. Altogether, there were four German kings in that century, so it might be important to cover who were the Salians, where did they come from? And it all starts with the two founders, Vanna of Worms and his son Duke Conrad the Red of Lorraine. So that's in modern day France, but it's the region between France and Germany historically. Conrad the Red died in 955, right at the turn of the last century, and without knowing it, founded a royal family. Now, Conrad the Red's wife was Luitgard, and she was the daughter of Emperor Otto I, the second king of the Saxon dynasty, but also known as Otto the Great. So he is just his name had a lot of gravitas throughout the whole Saxon Empire. And their son, Otto I, was Duke of Carinthia, which is Canton in modern Austria. It's the very roots of the modern state of Austria, started here in Carinthia. And he was the duke from 978 until 1004. So now we're definitely in the 11th century, and therefore also bringing Otto, this Cantish duke, or Carinthian duke, into the royal family on the maternal side. So now we have this new Austrian Franks sons. Duke Otto namely had three of them, Bruno, who became Pope Gregory V. So we can see this is an important noble family. He had Conrad, and he had Henry, who became Count of Speyer. And I'm going to come back to Speyer. Now, that last, and Count of Speyer also became the father of the Salian Emperor Conrad II. Who's our first emperor that we're going to cover. Now, Pope Leo IX, who I'm going to bring up again, he was in charge just for 5 years, from 1049 to 1054. He also had ties to the dynasty. His grandfather was Hugo III, was the brother of Adelheid, Adelheid. Okay, so that's the grandmother of Henry III. That's a king. That's the second king in this episode. I know I'm doing this really quick, but Adelheid, you might remember, she had drama all the way into her old age. She was a regent. She's Adelheid of Italy. Ran off to Burgundy. That whole drama from the last thing. So she's the grandmother of Henry III, which means Henry III is related, if you're paying close attention, Henry III is related on both sides to the Ottos. That might be important later. But if you're related to Adelheid, that means the noble family goes way back in Italy. The Vidonin go back to the Frankish conquests, like Carolinian times, so now the original Frank dynasty. So, point is, it's an old Frankish family with roots going back into the turn of the 10th century. That's it. If you care about the names, you have them. If not, let's keep moving. Now, again, this all carries gravitas because now they're all related to or married into Otto the First family. Anyways, that solidly brings us to Conrad II. Conrad was elected king and crowned in Mainz. He was born in 990. He's also known as Conrad the Elder, Conrad the Salic. And he was crowned first king of Italy in 1026 at the age of 36 or so, and instantly had his son crowned 2 years later. Why? Because, well, he was worried about succession. Why? Because, well, he was the first king of a dynasty, so he had to really cement his reign. That's kind of the ongoing theme here, so that's why I'm pointing that out. Now, he famously claims the Kingdom of Burgundy, Kingdom of Arles, which is what it was called under his successors. And the first thing Conrad does is, or an early thing he does, is when Henry V of Bavaria dies, he sets up his son Henry to be elected, who will, spoiler, will become Henry III. And now Mainz and Worms both play important roles. Worms, I just mentioned in passing because it's this is where the dynasty fathers came from, so Worms was secure. Mainz was secure because the bishop crowned him, so, and that's the bishop in charge. So obviously they were on good footing. Now what he did was he expanded Speyer. That was the third kind of county in the in this Salian, the stronghold of where the family came from, their noble holdings. And he really expanded Speyer from a farm town to a metropolis over time by building out the cathedral to balance its power and turn it into an imperial city. Now, I'm not mentioning Speyer for the first time because I did some foreshadowing. This is the first time I'm really introducing it, but Speyer is super critical for, and it's also really cool for a lot of neat reasons, so let me leave that for now. We'll come back to it. There's other ways in which Conrad had to take care of his inheritance and cement his rule very early on. And much like Otto the Great tried to get a Byzantine princess for Otto the Second, Conrad tries this too. And he fails, but it's important to well, I thought it was interesting that he harkens back to, you know, see what the last dynasty did, especially his own role. There was like four Ottonians, there's four Salians, so it's just kind of really interesting that they were going to see a lot of repetitive stuff here. But okay, so the next year after his coronation, instantly he has this great idea on how to get himself some prestige and cement this new dynasty, because he's not a Louis Dauphiner. So he goes big. He has this huge building project. Actually, specifically, the biggest. Now, first, he needed a canal from the Palatine Forest to the Rhine to secure enough lumber. And that's already a pretty big project. And that's just the infrastructure in order to start building. And I say start because it would take several centuries to really finish it up. But he would build the biggest cathedral in the Western world. In 1027 is when he started to lay the foundation, and under the rule of his sons, so Henry III, who I'm getting to in this episode, the cathedral, the Speyer Dom, would break the record and be the tallest structure in Western Europe. Still beat by things like the pyramids and so forth, but, you know, in the local vicinity, it was the tallest thing around. That should mean something. Now, the architecture, this is the Romanesque architecture that we see a continuation from, if you're interested in that kind of thing. That's why I bring it up. I find it interesting. And the way architecture changes has a lot to say about what the regime is trying to show. So we're still building Romanesque architecture like the Saxons did. They really started to do it. I guess the Franks kind of started, but we really see the continuation and obviously a grandiose evolution of this during the 11th and then continuing on to the 12th centuries. Now, Speyer becomes the burial site for Salian, Staufer, Habsburgs, all the future dynasties, not all, but several future dynasties for the emperors and kings. And it is from then on regarded as an imperial power, the way Goslar was before and still is. Now we add Speyer to the mix, and also Aachen. So we have all these, you know, these important cities that certain emperors tried to build upon and make their own status symbols, and then they became status symbols of later ones. So we have, in fact, now there's only one Romanesque building that's bigger. That would be the Abbey of Cluny, and it became ruins basically in the 18th century. So Speyer holds the record. Anyways, when Conrad was first elected and crowned, a steady reign was far from guaranteed, so he needed to travel, just again, like his predecessors, like Charlemagne, like Otto I, travel, gain support, go on campaign, if you will. So in this sense, history really does repeat itself. In Charlemagne, I gave that a lot of detail, what the actual court looked like in his time, and luckily we had sources, and it's really neat to see. He ruled from the saddle, is what was said of Otto I. Charlemagne, it was like him walking, he generally ruled outside in whatever field he happened to set up camp, more or less, and most of his court was held outdoors. Now, this was repeated in Otto's time, and now Conrad II does this too. Travel, gain support, build. And give a lot of money to the church, or, you know, stop off on the way, make the local bishops happy, that kind of thing. Two of Otto II's daughters held a warm welcome and received Conrad's entourage when they floated their way. And between these kind of signs of, you know, support and Conrad's promise to run things as the Saxon business as usual, the nobility accepted him, and he began to cement his rule. Now, even though I mentioned he has roots going back to northern Italy, in fact, all the way to the Lombard nobility stock, Italy, for political reasons, had nothing to do with them. They weren't so romantic or nostalgic that they wanted an Italian per se, and they had nothing to do with Conrad. So one of the first things he does, 1026, the same year he's crowned, is he gathers an army and heads south. And he heads south, again, he just kind of changes direction, keeps traveling south, leads a German army south of the Alps. And around northern Italy, he just kind of sat, ruled, played judge. And that's it. There's no major sieges, there's no big battles, but just his presence made the Italian nobility kind of fall in line by the following year. And so, just the next year, 1027, he is crowned Emperor of Rome with his wife, Knut the Great. Knut the Great, the great Danish ruler, was with him. And at this point, we're talking the king of a big chunk of England, Denmark, southern Sweden. So not just Danish, a really powerful king was right there in Rome when this happened. By that year, he'd wrapped up all the smaller revolts. By 1030, he had released all the people that was revolted. I jumped over this. In fact, I didn't say this at all, but one does not just simply switch dynasties. So he did have other pretenders to the throne. It was just because he was related to Otto I, and he just was one of the wealthier noblemen at the time, and one of the most liked, so people just elected him and backed him. There were other pretenders. History could have gone, you know, at least two or three different ways. Conrad ended up on top. And to show, or let's say the reason why I skipped it, is because you can see that within 3 years, everything was basically good. Basically. Hold on a second. Now, the Salians founded practically no monasteries, the Ottonians 8, but that's a weird statistics because the Salians definitely gave money to the church a lot. So, but they didn't ground any new monasteries. Now, Poland attacks because dynasty changed. They recognized the previous Ottos, but, you know, in a moment, this is a moment of weakness. Why not try their luck? Conrad thought this was a slight that first Boleslav, then Mieszko II, crowned themselves kings, and then just went off and attacked Saxony. But Conrad was able to defeat them and keep Poland as a vassal, which they were, at least nominally in this time under the previous Ottos. And the same with Bohemia, really. Conrad's son Henry is now old enough. This will be the later Henry III and already crowned king. He now leads his first military campaign against the Czechs and won. Less successful was a tiff with Hungary, and you guys will see that. I'm going to keep coming back to Hungary. But long story short, a truce was reached. War didn't break out again in Conrad's lifetime. It would in Henry's. Burgundy. So Conrad, especially Henry, becomes like a triple king. Burgundy is that other kingdom which Conrad just kind of took. He had no real rights, just like arguably he had no real rights to be German king. He definitely wasn't related to King Rudolf III of Burgundy. He died, but just kind of like Poland in this, testing the waters. Well, the old king died. Conrad tried his luck and just annexed it. Now, he just had himself crowned king of Burgundy, no matter what the French kings and, the other Aquitaines and those powers thought. And he just then promptly ignored Burgundy. It was just another notch in the belt and off he went. Now, it's important to note, though, that he did have Kingdom of Burgundy. It was part of the Holy Roman Empire at this time. And one reason why Knut the Great was in Rome was because he had already agreed to marry his daughter, Gunhild, to the son of Conrad. And so they had a big ceremony, one could say a big fest, on the 6th of June in 1036. And following that, she was anointed and then crowned by the Archbishop of Cologne. But it's around this time when Conrad hears some news, namely that one of his Italian noblemen was kind of thinking of leading a revolt. So Conrad goes back down to Italy. And as with the Saxons, we see that now, the second time to Italy, this German emperor needs to basically reconquer this area too, which is that I've said that sentence, I don't know, like three times now. So that just kind of happens. The northern Italian city-states would like to be independent, more or less. But Germany, it's such a tradition ever since Charlemagne for the last 200 years that their Holy Roman Empire includes Rome, which means it includes northern Italy. So anyways, he's besieging Milan, but it gets a little too hot in the summer, so he breaks it off. He captures a couple small towns around and finally Capua, but disease breaks out, and instead of dying like an Otto, he heads back north. That's wow, I'm impressed. But he did seem to suffer from the gout or some such affliction. Basically, he was complaining of joint and foot pain for several years, and he finally kind of got sicker and sicker, and he died rather suddenly in 1039. And his funeral procession was by boat up the Rhine, and his body was taken into the local churches along the way in Cologne and Mainz and Worms, and finally he was laid to rest in Speyer. And, let's just say the reviews are mixed. We have contemporary sources comparing the death of the Kaiser to a beloved family member. Other sources say that in the whole world, not a single person shed a tear over the Kaiser. So those are just conflicting reports. Now, his wife, Gisela, died 4 years later and was also buried in Speyer, taken to Speyer. And Conrad, just in historiography, like the opinion has changed because often he was compared to his predecessor, Henry II. I'll get back to the legacy of these two emperors. So right now I'd like to mention that we have the most peaceful, smooth transition in the whole Ottonian Salian time period. Kind of showing that this is one of the high points of imperial power within the Holy Roman Empire, and we'll see that kind of coming crumbling down with the investiture controversy and Henry IV and all that, but famously with Henry IV, like Germans all know this story. If I say, never mind, I don't want to give you spoilers, but yeah, so it's just because he was the trias, he was the triple count of Speyer, Worms, and Mainz, but above all, he was the triple king. So the Italian, the Ostfrankish or German, and then also the Burgundian, later Arles, kingdoms. Now, Conrad's reign was short, just like a dozen years or so. And he's been treated as basically a secular emperor, the emperor who consolidated internal power while showing a strong empire externally. Okay, but when in fact the whole viewpoint has been called into question in modern times since his, 15-year reign really didn't have a big of an effect as sometimes written. It really couldn't have. Some things were already into effect before, and some things, Conrad II does mark a high point of imperial power in the Holy Roman Empire. So basically 1939, it all goes downhill from here. Not quite. Not exactly. But we'll see. In any case, everything was all perfectly set up for the next in line. Everything went pretty smoothly. And so I'll formally introduce you now to Henry III. He was born in 1016 and ruled from 1039, although he was crowned before and already went off into battle, like we mentioned. And he was eventually crowned emperor on the 25th of December, 1046. Just to give you a couple of dates for reference. Now, he's also known as Henry the Black or Henry the Pious. He was already crowned king in Aachen under his dad's reign. His first tutor was Bruno of Augsburg, where he went to Augsburg. That is Quarrelsome Henry's son, by the way, who I've now mentioned in two episodes. And he was already Herzog of Bavaria, if you remember, like Duke of Bavaria. And after that, the Bishop of Freising tutored him, which is just north of Munich. So a lot of Bavarians raised him, basically. Now, Henry was crowned German king, and therefore the first Salier to be raised to take the throne. Like, he was groomed, educated to take over for his father. He was already made Duke of Bavaria and Swabia before his father died. And he was now 1016. He was actually born on the 28th of October. When I wrote this, it was like exactly 1,000 years ago. Like, to the day. Was kind of catching up, but that came and went. Anyway, so his accession to the throne was one of the markedly most seamless and painless in the whole timeline, in this whole 200-year span. And 1046, I'm going to say this sentence and then skip over it for now, but Henry ruled during the end of the papal schism in 1046. 1046 is a crazy important date in the history of the church, and I'm going to give that sentence justice in the next episode. Now, when he was only 11, Conrad came back from Italy, made him Duke of Bavaria and Regensburg. This was without precedence, because usually Bavarians held the title up until then. It was actually a bit of a scandal at the time. As a co-ruler under his father, his signet read Heinrichus Spes Imperii, the Hope of the Empire. Like I already mentioned, he married Gunhild, daughter of Canute the Great, but she died shortly after bearing a daughter. Now, in 1039, when his father died, he became the sole ruler, Imperator in spe, and so he traveled to gain support. Now, he was the triple duke, Bavaria, Swabia, and Canton, triple king, Germany, Burgundy, Italy, and again, a couple wars with Hungary, no big deal. Now, I said I'd come back to Hungary, and here it is. Conrad's failed invasion. They came to a peace in 1031, so a good 8 years prior. And this territory around the Danube, which was given to Germany by Stephen I of Hungary. Now, Stephen I, we've mentioned, he's a saint these days. He's the patron saint of probably Hungary, but many other things. But we mentioned his crown jewels in the Bohemian episode. They were in the States during World War II. So I don't want to, go listen to the Bohemian podcast with myself and Pete Coleman. But Stephen I of Hungary is super interesting. Basically, this border, he ceded this land to Germany, and that border that was established in 1030 stayed the border between Hungary and Austria until 1920. So the Versailles Treaty and the upcoming back and forths after World War I is what changed that border. That's 890 years. So Henry was remarried in Ingelheim in 1043 to Agnes, daughter of the Duke of William V of Aquitaine and Agnes of Burgundy, so cemented that Burgundian rule. There's a little bit of controversy here because, and I mentioned this at the very beginning, but she and Henry, when I mentioned why they were able to cement their reign so well, it's because she and Henry both descended from Henry the Fowler. He's the founder of the Ottonian dynasty. This caused some churchmen to oppose their union, but the marriage went ahead. But this is a huge scandal. Like, I was reading all kinds of things said by bishops at this time, and kind of, yeah, I mean, it was, if people wanted to point out some beef between the emperor and the church, this was one of those thorns in their side. So anyways, he split Lorraine when the duke died to weaken the duchy, and he had a campaign against Holland for a four-part of Lorraine against Count Dirk. And the Bohemian duke attacks Poland and steals the remains, the relics of Adalbert of Prague. Another Bohemian podcast episode. He brings them to Prague. Pete went and looked at them and reported back for the podcast. So again, that's a... So it's just kind of between all my shows, it's all coming together. The cathedral in Speyer grew ever higher into the air during Henry III's reign, eventually being 134 meters or almost some 400 feet and change, or actually almost exactly 400 feet. And what I was kind of saving for last here is their crypt underneath there. Like, it instantly brings to mind like the whole crypt underneath, like the Stark crypt in Game of Thrones, because it is a crypt where each little emperor has their own little place, which was by far the biggest in the whole empire. Plenty of room for future emperors were made. So really, I mean, this was planned out to make Speyer important in the future. And Henry actually had this tradition in his time of every year going to his beloved place. And records show him doing this up until Easter 1052. And there's all kinds of drama that took place in that cathedral between him and the bishops. Towards the end of his life, it's written that he liked Speyer less and less, or went there less and less. At times it must have had a special place in his heart, even this crypt. It's just kind of interesting. Now he does have to go and fight Hungary again, 1044. There's a lot of relics in this battle, the Battle of Menfur on the Rob River. And so he, you know, there's a famous tale of Henry taking off his shoes and socks, I don't know, his boots and whatever, and walking barefoot in the robes of a like repentant sinner and getting down to the ground, you know, kind of bowing before these relics, and orders his whole army to do the same. And then just a little bit later, he goes barefoot to Regensburg and praises God for his help in the battle. The churches of Regensburg were richer for it. And the whole reason he went in Hungary was to stop a pretender from the throne. And as soon as he leaves, Peter, this pretender, just gets right back on the throne. So there's no point. So he does win against Hungary. Peter, he would eventually be overthrown internally in Hungary. So there's no lasting peace there, but also nothing too critical. Much more relevant is that he appoints Adalbert Archbishop of Bremen. He summons Widger, Archbishop of Ravenna, to a trial. Now, okay, so a German secular court trying an Italian bishop, this did not go over well. And this is a precursor almost to the investiture controversy. This was really some of the stuff that would lay the groundwork of what the emperor can do, what the pope can and can't do. This starts a lot of beef. So meanwhile, in Rome, and this adds to it, we have three popes, Benedict IX, Sylvester III, Gregory VI. They all kind of contested appointments by Henry III, so we see some more beef raising here. Benedict was an Italian who had previously renounced the throne. So Henry first marched to Verona, then to Pavia. Boy, this sounds familiar. He held court and dispensed justice. So he ruled things from Pavia for a while. I'm still talking about Henry III, not like Otto II or, you know, all these other guys, Conrad II for that matter. But then he heads down towards Rome and he declares no Roman priest fit. Now, Adalbert of Bremen refuses the honor. Henry appoints another one who was pretty popular, so that's fine. And he becomes Clement II, who then, on Christmas Day, 1046, first Clement has to be consecrated, then he can consecrate Henry, and in fact he does consecrate Henry and Agnes, and were crowned Holy Roman Emperor and Empress. And now again, here's another little piece of controversy that could be taken in a couple different ways. The populace, so the Romans themselves, seemed to like Henry and gave him a golden chain of basically making him patricius. Now, does this make him a patricius like the Crescenti family during the previous, like the 10th century, who had the power, or at least seemingly had the power, to just nominate popes? Well, why? I mean, now you could argue that he does. So, yeah, anyways, Henry's first acts are to visit Frascati, the capital of the Counts of Tusculum, and seize all their castles from the Crescenti. So apparently he's sees himself as taking over that family's political power. And he and the Pope then moved south, where his father had created the situation as it was, and Henry reversed many of Conrad's acts. The time that Conrad spent ruling from northern Italy was kind of made moot. Yeah, the reason he chose Clement was he definitely needed to be crowned emperor. That's for sure. And he also definitely wanted to make sure that no one would question the Pope crowning him emperor. So Clement was a popular one, and that made him popular. Okay, now this is all super, this is really important. And there's just, so in church history, that we'll come back to this on with Steve Guerra from the History of the Papacy. But there was a synod, the synod in Sutri, where they talked about simony. Simony is selling roles or titles or positions to, well, the highest bidder, which that's, you know, in the Bible, that was, there was a Simon that did that. And so it's called after him. And that's a sin. You don't do that. That's not good. But it happened all the time in this time period, just blatantly and openly. And so, you know, from that point of view, it was extremely corrupt, and that didn't help things. While Henry's in Rome, he ends the papal schism. This frees the papacy from the dependence of the Roman nobility. Now, why did he do this? He seems to give up a lot of power here, but he kind of has to make that compromise. It's already really late in his reign. He's been ruling for like a dozen years now without being emperor. So he needs this to happen. And so he needs this to happen without a bunch of pretenders saying, oh, this is like pretenders to the throne, or detractors saying this was not a legitimate coronation. He needs everything to be legitimate. That's all I'm going to say now. We'll dive into this next episode. But this, first of all, does two things. It divorces the church from under the emperor's thumb just enough, just a little bit, and it also lays the foundation for the Catholic Church to truly and honestly not just be a puppet of the German Empire, which, if that didn't change right now, 1,000 years ago, I doubt all of Latin America would be Catholic and Poles and so forth. I mean, they really, so this is what makes the Catholic Church a universal church, as they would like to be seen. That's why France was Catholic and England until the Reformation, or until, you know, Henry VIII and that whole thing. So yeah, we have another 500 years of the whole Western world being Catholic, except for the Orthodox Byzantines and those, and the Slavs more and more. It's because of this Henry III's reign and this papal schism and all that, which we're going to talk about next time. Super critical, jumping over it for now. Now, Henry spent some time rejiggering the counties in Italy, then filling vacant roles in Germany, when finally a proper uprising broke out. Dirk of Holland and his allies, they sacked Charlemagne's palace at Nijmegen, burned Verdun, the rebels besieged Liege, and Henry was, you know, on the warpath this whole time. Henry of Bavaria dies, which kind of slows his march. He has to give up Upper Lorraine. While this is all happening, the Pope dies. Henry chose Popo of Brixen, who take the name Damasus II, who doesn't last very long. So Henry of Bavaria has died, so he gives that to a Kuno at Ulm. Swabia he gives to Otto of Schweinfurt, so just appointing more noblemen to these empty duchies. Henry met with Henry of France. Damasus, the Pope that he just anointed, dies, so envoys from Rome come seeking a new pope, and Henry announces or selects Bruno of Toul, who becomes Leo IX. He's, I say that with emphasis because that's important next episode. Leo IX, that would divide church between East and West. They just said, we've had enough. We excommunicate the Byzantine church, and the Byzantines do the same. And they're both So this is really interesting in church history. They both consider themselves the universal church and the others as heretics from this date. Before, they were trying to mend that gap on some nominal level. They were also fighting for power. The Byzantines thought they should rule Rome, and vice versa. So finally, they just kind of split. While that's happening, Dirk of Holland was killed in 1049. And 1051, and that's good for Henry because just 2 years later, we find him marching towards Hungary again in the opposite direction. This time, he's defeated. His troops fled the battlefield. The battlefield was called, the place where the battle took place, that range of hills was called Vertus, like the armored hills, because of all the discarded armor of German knights who fought and fled. So he eventually, he was forced to give up Hungary. He unsuccessfully besieged Pressburg on his way out. That's the current capital of Slovakia. There's a little war in Poland. There's war in Flanders. He spends Christmas in Goslar. He names another pope, the last of Henry's four German popes, who becomes Victor II. And yeah, I mean, so Henry did well because he was the triple duke of Bavaria, Swabia, and Canton that he could pull directly from, like tax directly, get men from directly. Never before had a Roman German ruler had such a wide power basis, you could say. Now, the church got stronger. They were making tax-free money from selling immunities. It's in Henry's the Third's time where the church says, well, we start to get define the roles between church and state, actually. This is where that really starts. And it is said now that it is the king's mission to have peace on earth. This is a medieval idea. This is where that comes from. And it should be pointed out in summary that Henry appointed a bunch of popes. He really was very hands-on and very generous with church politics. So they all were, granting more land and more money to the church at Goslar, for instance. This would have consequences, dire, huge, dramatic consequences for Henry IV, or so we'll see that in the coming episodes. And on the 5th of October, not yet 40 years old, Henry dies suddenly at Bodfeld. This is a hunting lodge in the Harz Mountains, the old Saxon core territory. And his heart went to Goslar, his body to Speyer, to lie next to his father's and the family vault in the Speyer Dome, the Cathedral of Speyer, that crypt where he hung out at least once a year. And Henry III does have quite the legacy. He was one of the most powerful of the Holy Roman Emperors, as in his direct authority. As the king in Burgundy, Germany, Italy, this was only rarely questioned. All those titles were just like, yep, that's fine. And his power over the church, as we're about to see, would never be the same, really. So this was the root of what the reformers he sponsored later fought against his son with. So, which is maybe ironic, maybe a little treasonous, who knows, not very loyal, but that happened. So in his reign, he did bind, he didn't lose a lot of vassals. He was able to consolidate reign and make his allies closer, all that. But his successors would inherit all of his problems. So Henry III did not live long enough to deal with his consequences, is one way to put it. And the investiture controversy was largely a result of his church politics, which was beneficial to him, but gave up a lot of power long term. He united all these duchies, save Saxony, to himself at one point, like we said, but he also gave them all away. So, you know, that's weird. But not only did he embiggen the cathedral at Speyer, there's also the Kaiserpfalz, the imperial residence at Goslar, which became quite impressive under his reign. He was his reputation was as a peace-loving ruler. He was already, in continuation with the Merovingians and Carolinians. He was compared to King David, as was Henry II, Conrad II. So yeah, they were all kind of, it's an honorary title to compare them to King David. But we see this a lot under Henry III. I said right at the beginning of introducing him that he was also known as Henry the Pious. And maybe this was just in a romantic sense or like a wishful thinking sense, because King David kind of brings to mind the time of a, you know, the dawning of a golden age, you know, with Solomon and all that. So that, yeah, but why not? Anyways, he dies at 1046, not quite 40 years old. He ruled for less than 20 years. He was only emperor for 12. That's quite a stretch. And now his early death was regarded as a disaster, much less ambiguously than Conrad's. Where, like I said, some people said no one shed a tear. You know, this was felt throughout the empire. And again, with his son, the Holy Roman Empire, the Catholic Church, would once again change significantly, like forever. In the century of the Saliers, just about everything changed. We are nearing the end of an era, or the beginning of one, depending on how you want to look at it. And the next episode should be the investiture controversy, then on with Henry IV and him crawling on hands and knees to visit the Pope, wearing a hair shirt, begging for forgiveness. So, not exactly the high point of imperial power anymore. The History of Germany podcast is a proud member of the Agora Podcast Network, and the podcast of the month belongs to Eric and Xander from Reconsider, which is an awesome podcast. They just did an episode with Heather Tesco from the English Renaissance podcast. I highly recommend that one. But Reconsider is a great show. Also, we hit the 25-episode mark with The Secret Cabinet, which I'm actually just an adoring fan that translate the original from Der Buddler, Das Geheime Kabinett from German. I love that show, The Secret Cabinet. So episode 25, very strange facts from history. But the last one was Der Buddler went to England and saw, or the Eagle and Child, where J.R.R. Tolkien and C.S. Lewis hung out and across the street. So kind of took a pilgrimage there and gave us some stories of that locale. Otherwise, for many other topics around this time period, visit bohemican.com, because I tend to leave things out that I've already spoken about before, like Adalbert of Prague or Stephen I of Hungary, or those characters that pop up in this episode. We covered that. If you want to know more about Canute the Great and why we did an episode on Dannevirke, that's like two episodes back. Otherwise, don't forget to check out my new podcast, Africa, A History, which I think will be more collaborative. Recently, let's see, I did an episode on the Rwandan genocide, and then most recently, Spice Island, Zanzibar, and my own visits to Eastern Africa and Tanzania. So do me a favor, check that out. As always, the best way to help a new show or any show at all is a review on iTunes. All my shows and further links to social media, how to get in contact with me and so forth, is on podcastnik.com. That's podcastnik.com. There is a new History of Germany t-shirt out, if I haven't mentioned that before. It's on the Vandals. It's pretty cool. That's linked to there. There's slowly but surely more t-shirt designs coming out because we have a graphic designer that does a great job. I am loving these. So go do me a favor and just check those out. You basically buy me a beer if you buy a t-shirt. That's always appreciated. Otherwise, vielen Dank fürs Zuhören und bis zum nächsten Mal.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.